You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show. Over the past weeks, we've been bringing you coverage of the 2010 U.S. Social Forum, an unprecedented gathering of almost 18,000 progressive activists that took place in Detroit. People came from all walks of life, of every age and race and creed, gathered to learn from one another about the struggles for social justice happening right here in communities across the nation. We were on the ground in Detroit to bring those voices to you. So stay tuned this hour to hear an interview with Ole Lake, who fights for environmental justice for indigenous communities in Alaska. Music and conversation with Palestinian hip-hop artist Abir, who lives right here in Baltimore. And a talk with Janet Redman of the Institute for Policy Studies that explores the links between climate change and social change. First, we'll go to Ole to hear why he thinks the decision to make Alaska a state was an illegal annexation. Here at the U.S. Social Forum, we're about to have a conversation with Ole Lake, who is from Alaska. He is here with the Indigenous Environmental Network, and Ole, it's good to meet you.
Thank you.
Thank you for doing this today. It's good to have you here. So there's a lot. All the things you said before we sat down with these things, before this machine was turned on, you said a lot. But I'd like to ask you first, and wind my way back to what you were saying, to give our listeners an understanding of what the Indigenous Environmental Network is.
Well, that group is independent on itself that I am not totally part of, but they sponsor and support our efforts. And like if an organization have a hard time or individuals have a hard time paying their own way to a site of conference, they fill in the gap, and another organization would come and fill in the gap of where I would stay or feed me or what's up, whatever they wanted me to do. So it's a very good thing that a few organizations collaborate and help out with this kind of process.
So tell us about your story. You said you're part of the Yupik Nation from Alaska?
Yes, I'm Yupik. My Yupik name is Ulik, which has several meanings, and I'll just tell you three of them or two of them or
as many as you'd like.
Ulik means the white fox that roams the coastal plains of Alaska. And it also means the mirage you see out in the horizon that make you able to see what's on the other side of the mountains and or plain. And it also means the animals and the crustaceans and things that are revealed when the tide goes out. And last but not least, my iluks, meaning my cousins, we tease each other about what it really means is to take the blanket off. But it really means that revealing, you know, taking the blanket off to reveal what is hidden or cannot be seen.
I like that. So in the Yupik language, I mean, there many words have multiple meanings?
Yes. Depending on where you come from. No.
Does it have to do with how the word's pronounced, or is it...
No, it's you know, the Yupik language is very complex, and I'll explain in a little bit that the one word could mean a sentence in an English language, and some words has to be explained in a paragraph. So that's how advanced our Yupik language is in relation to what is around us, how we describe our environment, and especially the unseen world.
Especially the unseen world. I like that. Well, I hope we had time to hear more about that. So talk about the struggle you were talking about earlier that you all were going through. And
there's many struggles like all the rest of the indigenous people around the world are facing. Especially political and environmental, governmental, and so forth. And mainly that we still retain our language. We're the second largest English Yupik speaking, indigenous speaking group in the world, nation, besides Navajo.
Navajo.
Mm-hmm. So and. You know, our history with the United States is not very old. It's very young and very adolescent, so to speak. Because I say that because it has been imposed, irregardless of if we fully understood the concept of becoming a state and or part of the United States. That process mainly was implemented through the assimilated group of people that took on the leadership of organizations, political systems, corporate systems, and so forth. So, like any other group in the world that has helped another agency take over the lands and waters and languages and resources, it's happening to us too. And if you know that we recently sued the state for violating the rights of the people on the Voting Rights Act, it's just recent this winter that we won a lawsuit on behalf of four villages and several people, but in reality, it represents the whole area in the Yupik country, because very many legislative processes have been passed through the system without being fully explained and translated to the people, which itself violates the Voting Rights Act. And if you see the sequential aspect of how all of these involved, having been a free country to becoming a territory, becoming a state, now being part of the United States. And many of the factors that happened during that time begin with the Statehood Act. You know, it wasn't the people that chose to become a state. It was a very few people, individuals, and that influenced all of this process. And some has admittedly said that the process that they're going through in order for this to happen is illegal. They admitted that themselves. It's recorded in their language. But the misinformation or exclusion of information that's supposed to go out to the people themselves was not fully translated and explained. And only the positive aspect of becoming that was explained, not the negative consequences to our human rights, our land ownership, our clean water rights, and so many other rights that we as human beings have all over the world. I know that these were violated. So in that perspective, I say it's illegal to do that anywhere, any place around the world. And the majority doesn't mean that you have the right to achieve anything on account of a few, the minority, so to speak, but we are not the minority. You know, in the essence, the presence of the original people is still there, but we call it the rail belt. And people from all over the world have settled that and taken over that whole dynamics there.
So what is the focal point of the Only Voting Rights Act struggle? What's the focal point of what's happening to the Yupik people now and what and the resistance you are?
Explaining it further, we have the right to know what we're voting for, and the translation was never accurate in the first place. And some of the terminology that were put into the voting system is always say, you know, so to speak, yes means no, no means yes, you know? And that's very confusing to anyone, mm-hmm. even the English-speaking people in the world,
mm-hmm.
and they want the right to be informed of the actualities of what they're voting for, and to look back to see how many times that has been violated over the years since contact or since statehood. You can see that there were very many votes, and probably most of it was not understood or explained clearly to the benefit of the people themselves, but not. It was very detrimental, in my opinion.
So tell me why you're here. Why did you come to the U.S. Social Forum? That's right.
It's my personal interest, really, that the gathering of information has not reached the people themselves in their own languages, from their own people, with their own perspectives. It was always delivered to them and or not delivered at all. always, like I was said, yes means no, and no means yes kind of approach to a lot of things. And all the regulatory systems in Alaska, like EPA, and I'm not afraid to mention all these agencies because I worked with them before, negotiated with the Department of Defense and other cleanup agencies that were supposed to be working on behalf of the people's safety and food safety and so many things. But in reality, it was made easier for the state and feds and other corporations to do whatever they want to do in our country and waters.
So when you do go back, when you go back to Alaska, I'm curious about, you talked earlier about the struggles between the villages and the kind of communications you had to set up so everybody would know. Talk a bit about what you were saying before we got on these mics. They kind of pick people out of there.
You know, there's very many agencies in Alaska, very many programs in Alaska. There's very many institutions and so forth that are supposedly geared to help people with their land safe, land ownership, land safety, food safety, land use, and so many other factors. Like I said that the regular procedure seems to me is allowing that to happen and making it easy for corporations and others to do what they want to do and not explain the true consequences of if we choose to go that route, this is going to happen. Instead, they show us the clean side of everything, sterilized side of the processes, and therefore we end up with the loss and or damage and or change that did not include us.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're listening to continuing coverage from the 2010 U.S. Social Forum in Detroit. Next up, an interview with Palestinian hip-hop artist and social justice activist Abir. Mark Steiner here, and we are about to begin our last interview, I think, here at the U.S. Social Forum on our way out of town, crossing paths, a sister from Baltimore and from Palestine, all at the same time, is Abir, who's been with us before. She performed here last night at the Social Forum. Good to see you, Abir. How are you?
Good to see you. I'm good. How are you?
Looking good?
Yeah. Happy to hear it's your last interview.
Yeah, well, my last interview of the day.
Good job.
This is cool.
Yeah, good job.
So, last night you had a performance.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us why you came to the Social Forum. What were you doing here last night?
Well, I was invited by my friend Noor Arikat to come in. She's a lawyer and a part of the USNCP. And she invited me to take part of the Palestinian program. And we wanted to showcase, you know, Palestinian culture. And I bring some kind of a mixed culture between the hip-hop and the Palestinian one. And I wanted to reach out for everybody here who comes to this place to show my appreciation to the solidarity they have with the Palestinian struggle and with the Palestinian people. And it was a very beautiful evening. Lots of mess, because usually these events go along with a lot of mess, but always the outcome is so satisfying. And the love you get from people, and the so much open-minded people that you meet around here from different backgrounds, it makes it so worth it, so worth this work.
I want you to talk a little bit about your feelings, understanding, and analysis of hip-hop as the sound of resistance. Mm. Throughout the world.
I mean, music was always the... Oh, wow.
Go ahead, jumping in.
Mm. Music was always the method of people to, you know, to express themselves beyond what the society, government, or whatever, you know, whoever sets the rule. Music was always the outlet. Hip-hop comes as the outlet, but, you know, with a stronger, fierce... clear, it's very similar to the rock and roll idea back in the day. It's a very fierce statement about, you know, what you think and what you see and how you take the world in. And for me to express my resistance to any regime I'm not happy with, because as a human being first and most important, it's very important to me that I do it in a, first of all, an honest way, which hip-hop, you know, provides you with this privilege, because that's the type of genre it is. Nobody writes your music. Nobody writes your... You write what's on your mind. And what's on my mind is a lot of resistance to this country, to its regimes, to the fact that it supports, other military governments. And I have a lot to say about it. And hip-hop is a wonderful way for me because I could say whatever I want and... People will expect me to say whatever I want since I'm a hip-hop artist. So it's the best way of resistance for me. It's harmful, but in a way that you don't really get touched physically. It's harmful because it comes to your mind and challenges you. And those who don't want to be challenged see it as harmful. I see it as pretty, harmless, cute genre.
Cute?
But that's me. I'm used to it. Yeah. The first time I heard it, it was not so cute. Once you get used to it, once you jump deep and dive into what these people are talking about, I realize I also want to be doing this. And this is a great place to come and showcase Palestinian hip-hop as a tool of resistance against the U.S. military and against Israeli military and any other country that...
But your work as a hip-hop artist... Mm. I mean, it's and the sound that you bring to the work as well as the words you write. I mean, they infuse a bunch of different things. I mean, they infuse you as a Palestinian woman who lives in Israel, in that world. It's infused with your work as a woman in the Palestinian world and that resistance. And it's the music itself is infused with the sound of all those things.
Right.
You know, the Arab sound. Even a little Israeli sound, American, like hip-hop, the woman's power.
Right.
I mean, that's what you're marrying.
The fact that I was born with an Israeli citizenship as a Palestinian person already brings all these contradictions in my music.
Right.
Because I'm maybe one of the, there are not many Palestinian artists who would tell you, I don't have a problem with Israel as a country. I have a problem with the way it exists. And I bring that into my music. I bring not just, the Palestinian point of view, but the woman point of view as well, because it's the same thing for me. Occupation is occupation, whether it's mentally, physically, emotionally, it's still occupation. And as I told you before on our last interview, that Zionism for me was always, a type of ownership, and somebody wants to do whatever they want because they're in charge. They decided that they're superior to other people, and as a woman, I feel like somebody wants me to feel like I'm beneath them. Whether it's men, whether it's Israelis, whether it's soldiers, or American politicians, it goes around. And my music includes all of that, all of this. Not anymore so much anger, since the music help you. It's kind of some sort of therapy. The more you talk, you're like, oh my God, I'm the best shrink that I could ever have, because I write my own lyrics. I understand, whoa, I have so many issues. And then it becomes less and less anger and more just a way to express how I feel without being so mad about it, because I have the privilege to write. I do have the privilege to sing. And it has to do with the fact that I was born in specific places, in specific families. It has to do a lot with who I am in general. And I take everything. I don't know how to write about anything else that I am. It's literally impossible for me. I tried many times to write, a love song that is perfect. Ain't no such thing for me. So I feel like the fact that I'm a woman, a Palestinian woman who was born in Israel, who immigrated to the U.S., all these things are, powerful in my music, and you could feel it. You could see it.
I'm interested also in how you talk about this, your own internal battle with your music and your world about not letting the anger control you, that you're trying to find a place where your music and soul is saying something else.
Again, it started from a place of anger to do hip-hop. I loved how they're just tough, and they sing it and they curse, and it's exactly what it is. And the anger fades in it because I've done my part. I've done my part, and I feel very, very, very happy to be able to not only write and sing, but have an audience that's interested in what I say and have solidarity with what I say. So when you have, no longer just people saying no to you, all of a sudden people say, okay, I want to hear what you say. The anger goes from being very angry to being very accepted and accepting other people. And it helped me a lot to be able to listen to different opinions without judging the person who's saying, because I've changed a lot in my life. I used to have horrible opinions. When I was in the sixth grade, I used to say, oh my God, Hamas is, you know, destroying my life. Because that's as much as I knew. Because that's what the TV showed me. Mm-hmm. So I try to come with this attitude towards anybody I meet. And I understand that maybe they don't have enough knowledge or did not get to get to the awareness that I have. Or so there is less anger when you have more understanding of how different people are and how the media takes over most of our lives. Whatever we see on the news is what we speak to each other. So, and this is where I come in as a, you know, as a, my role as an artist is to bring a different type of source for news, maybe, or for feelings, or for opinions. And there is not much anger anymore. I still have a lot of anger towards, you know, actions that, you know, taken against people. That's something that, well, I don't think I'll ever get over. You know what I mean? When you hear of massacre, right. I mean, some people live with that. You know, they say, what do I care? Things are happening in Palestine. So things are happening in Arizona. Things are happening. They don't care about it. It's not close to them. It's far enough for them not to see it. And I want to be able to connect and communicate, you know, regardless of where we are, where you are and where I am, we must be able to meet on the mental idea that we have no right to take over somebody's life. We have no life to, right to take his life. And we have no right to separate people and start dividing more and more and more. I these are things that I believe in. I don't, not in any point, no matter who it is that's being hurt, that will I be on the side of the oppressor. I always, always rather be the oppressed one. So I could say, you know, we're going to fight this and feel, go to sleep at night normally.
So do you think that when you think about, I mean, there's every movement, every kind of battle for human rights has had a cultural and musical part of it, a component, part of its soul. And clearly hip-hop is part of that soul of this new movement coming up from the bottom in this country and around the world. And you represent that in a very strong way, I think your music does, and you do. So when you look around this place here, because you're only here for a day, but when you look around this place and there seems to me this connective tissue is happening between many cultures and many people. That how does that infuse you? How does that infuse your music? How does that infuse your resistance?
I mean, it makes it even stronger. Because something that I've learned in the last day is that we have much more in common than we know. And once we realize that we somehow invented these differences between us or accepted the invention of being different, and it makes it weird to live and think, you know, are we different because of our color? Are we different because of our class? What makes us different? And when you see so many people from different backgrounds sitting in the same place trying their best to be able to reach some kind of a solution about the subject that they're fighting for, you have to understand that it shows you that not only the government exists. There are different levels of resistance and different levels of power, and musicians are somewhere in that layer, because artists are always used, whether by, you know, I mean, even Hitler asked, you know, filmmakers to make him look amazing.
Right.
So artists are always, they always have this touch, you know, to take over somebody's sympathy. That's what it mostly used for. To get sympathy from people. I get it to get more and more solidarity and more determination that we, the people, have the right to take part of the life that we live here and not just follow some rules that somebody wrote without us being, you know, we have to be always questioning the government's decisions. We have to, I mean, it's funny, you know, the government works and say it's for the people when it's, you know, screwing the people. So it makes no sense. And that's where the people, which I believe happens in this kind of conferences, that the people come and sit down and let's try to figure it out. You know what I mean? So it makes me feel, I don't know if it's hope.
I was about to ask you, do you have hope?
Right. You know what? I lose and find hope 5-6 times a day.
Exactly. Yeah. Right.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean, you think we could totally change what's going on. We might even bring the Israeli wall sooner than we thought. And then you're like, oh my God, this is gonna be very hard. It's gonna be. They just attacked a flotilla. They just like something happens that make you feel very hopeless, and then something happens that makes you feel very hopeful. And we gotta keep this balance somehow. If we don't always feel hopeless, then we're good. At least that. What do we do next? This is not really our jobs to... I don't believe we're here to maintain something forever. We're here for a limited time. We're guests on this earth. My job is to keep something good left behind me for whoever is going to come, because I inherited a lot of power from people who fought before me and maybe didn't have hope. But I suck their energy and what they've done. I even study freedom songs from slavery days just to see how did they keep going. I don't have, you know, shackles around my hands and feet. And so is it a bit better? You know what I mean? Is our occupation and slavery becoming more mental? But really, we control our minds. You know what I mean? So we do have a role. We do have some kind of power. And many people don't even know that. They don't even know that they could change. They could, because it comes from within you first. And if you don't change yourself, you're not going to help all these people you meet here. You know what I mean? All these hundreds of people that meet, if they didn't reach a resolution within themselves, it's going to be very hard for them to transfer it to the community. They must be, I don't want to say complete, because that's literally impossible. But we have to be at least certain with what we think of. We have to be determined not to change our minds because it's getting harder, or the economy is way too hard for me to pay attention to things like that, and so on and on and on. So it's definitely hopeful, at a point where I don't give up ever on life, for me first and then everybody else.
I can tell you that in our times together, your wisdom is growing by leaps and bounds. It's good to see you again.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I'm very happy you're always willing to listen to me.
Always.
last time we spoke, and I sent that link to people.
Oh, right.
They were shocked you and I got along so well.
Why?
Because they were like, you guys are both almost on the same level when it comes to the craziness of what you say. And you still get along because you're both crazy, I guess. And, you know, we believe in things that are similar, but we come from totally different backgrounds.
We do.
So people expect us not to get along.
Was.
And we prove that, you know.
It's not true.
You know, I could get along with someone who always was taught that Zionism is a good thing, and I was always taught, you know,
right,
or saw it as a bad thing. We could both reach this place that we agree on basic things that has nothing to do with definitions like Zionism.
No, it's
or
true.
Not.
I mean, because I grew up, I was talking the other day, I grew up believing Zionism as a liberation movement.
Exactly.
But liberation movements, often when they get into power, they began to sour and turn on themselves and turn on the people that they thought they were liberating, and oppressed people in the process of their own liberation.
Right. I mean,
so
I doubt that Zionism started on the basics of liberation.
In people's heads it did. Not as a
movement. That's the thing. The movement itself was not, but the people needed that so bad.
Right.
They needed a homeland so bad. The prejudice against Jewish people in Europe was taken, you know, and probably British people didn't know what to do with Jewish people. So they were like, you know what, we need an ally in the Middle East. Let's go put them there.
Right.
You know what I mean? And then we'll figure it out, which didn't...
Well, those people there didn't really have a land to begin with, so we'll just give them this land.
Right, but
take that.
Yeah, they definitely... So many people I meet say, there was nobody in Palestine. What are you talking about?
And I'm like,
yeah, there is no, like, just like, you know, North America was empty of people,
as they claim.
But
are
I
there
do.
People here?
I mean, only, you know, natives who take care of the land very well. But yeah, like you said, there's a saying that says, you know, a day after the revolutionary is not going to be longer than a revolutionary.
Right.
So that's the facts of life. And we still challenge that.
We have to.
Yeah.
All right, girl. Good to see you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good always.
Thank you.
You've been listening to our footage from the 2010 U.S. Social Forum. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.
تعود تشوف بنات تقدر تعمل اللي بتي
Mark's Diner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's New Easy. You can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com.
بناها القد صغير النائي هاني لكل جنس تكلي طفاني من أراء النعسانة أنا الكتبت أنا اللحان أنا الغنيت أنا راح تجيب جيش بنات كمل عني زنة ثالثة بالمجلس البيت عيشة تركي الساعة
قدام أسكت ولا عاصفة منصة أطلع من حقت لفت ريقت قد ما بنات قبلت ملانة غاني كتبت ثورة جديدة خلقت صوتي دكتور أحلامي في ديك صار كتاب خطط كيف أخلي المنصة شايفك تحلم فيه واليوم يمكن أنا مش لقيتي والشباب بهرب بدل ما يوقعوا بحبي
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. You're listening to the Mark Steiner Show, public radio WEAA 88.9 FM. You've been listening to our footage from the 2010 U.S. Social Forum, which gathered 18,000 progressive activists in Detroit. Listen now for a conversation we had with Janet Redman from the Institute for Policy Studies about why we need to build a new green economy and how to do it. I'm Mark Steiner. We're doing another conversation here at the U.S. Social Forum. We're fortunate to have Janet Redman with us. She's from the Institute for Policy Studies. Was in Copenhagen and Cochabamba. Now she's in Detroit. So,
I'm getting around.
You're getting around. Getting around.
Climate scene.
Jen, let's start off just introducing you and your work to our listeners. And you, tell us about the work you're doing at IPS.
Sure. So at IPS, for quite some time, actually, we've been looking at climate finance. In part, that's been thinking about how public money is spent around climate, around energy. We've been tracking the World Bank and how they spend money, how they spend public dollars, exacerbating the climate change problem, and then trying to solve it with the other hand. So we've been trying to show some of the contradictions, the way that we're spending money around climate. More recently, though, we've been moving into thinking about what are some of the positive solutions, talking about how to use the financial system to help us heal the planet as well. So we're looking at the connection between the financial crisis that just happened recently and the climate crisis, and looking at the roots and causes of those crises and how we can formulate solutions that address both problems.
I'm very curious about that. Sure. I clearly want to get into the conversations about the conference, the forum here, and
yeah.
And what you've been doing in these different fora around the world. But one of the sticking points, this whole question of climate change and finance, is the fear that there's no way to do something else. I mean, there's two things. But let's just start with that. The idea that we can't have clean energy, we can't kind of move into a new world because that transition, A, is going to take too long, and B, as many wealthy investors have said to me, well, not many, several I've talked to, but have said to me that they will not invest in clean energy until they see it's financially viable and they
right.
can make a dollar.
Right. No, I think that's true. I mean, I think this is the interesting convergence, right? There are two things that are happening. One is, you know, overall, just to kind of maybe take a step back and look at the bigger picture, the climate crisis, climate change, global warming, the way I think about it, it's the physical manifestation of an economic system that's totally out of control, right? So climate change is the consequence of having an economy that's based on the idea of extracting, without any consequence, without recognizing that actually the Earth's resources are limited, both in terms of what we can pull out of the plant, out of the ground, mm-hmm. and also what the atmosphere can absorb. So that's the kind of global warming conundrum, is that we don't actually operate that way. We don't operate as if we have an economy, that we have a planet that's finite. And so our economy is out of control for the, it doesn't match up with reality. So there's, you know, one whole set of, we're going to have to change that whole system then of how we think about an economy, which is basically how we take care of ourselves. Like, what should economy do? An economy should make us able to clothe ourselves, feed ourselves, house ourselves, achieve the kinds of things we want to achieve as people, live well, the idea of living well. Instead, right now, our economy is about making as much profit as possible and hoping that jobs are a part of that process, right? So we need to really change the frame of how our economy works. That's a long-term project. And so that part's about changing energy systems, changing the way we produce energy. We need to do that more localized, disaggregated, decentralized. People having sovereignty over where the energy comes from, how it's used, how it's consumed. Again, that's the trajectory that we want to be on. So, but more immediately, like, we're going to turn the lights on today and tomorrow, and that still has consequences for the planet and for people around the world. So yes, there are a set of market incentives that can say a windmill is cheaper than going and digging a new coal pit. And those things do need to change immediately. And that's, you know, that's part of what the legislative cycle is about, and thinking about global warming or climate change legislation, incentivizing financially things like clean energy, like wind power, solar power versus nuclear power or quote unquote clean coal. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's a market signal that has to be set right now. And there are ways to do that. I mean, there are lots of ways to do that. Actually, there are things like ending the subsidies for fossil fuel. We could start by just not paying for the problem, which is what we're doing right now, just cutting that off and switching that, taking that money that we would have, subsidies we would have given to fossil fuel, and actually giving that to renewable energy. So yeah, we need to change how cheap bad energy is, and really internalize the costs both to health, to the planet, and to long-term sustainability. That will make the price signal match reality a little bit better, which then gives investors that signal to say, okay, I'm gonna make less money doing the bad stuff. Hopefully eventually get the price signals right that I make money doing the good stuff. But again, that's a short-term vision. That's inside of a larger vision of changing the way the economy works overall.
So, very quickly again, what's the connection that mm-hmm. when you do your talks between and your writing between the crash we saw on Wall Street and this climate crisis we face?
And I think very specifically the idea that the financial crisis and the climate crisis have at their root cause the idea that the economy is for the benefit of those who can extract and profit, as opposed to decentralizing the good that economy does. So with the financial crisis, it was about Wall Street bankers, about fat cats, you know, doing rapid transactions all around the world. It's not contributing to the real economy. It's not part of goods and services that are serving communities and people. It's kind of a ghost economy. It's an electronic economy that's about these financial trades. We need to design a system immediately. We need to put things in place in terms of policy now that reduce the incentives for that. So, for example, a financial transactions tax is one of the things that people have been talking about around the world. What that does is put a tiny tax on every transaction. So every time you do a swap or a stock trade or a derivative trade, for example, it puts a tiny, tiny tax, 0.25% in some cases, 0.1%, 0.005% on currency transactions, which makes it less attractive to do those super rapid trades that aren't part of distributing goods and services mm-hmm. to people. The nice overlap is that actually that's money that's needed to help countries in the global south adapt to climate change, to move to a low carbon growth path. So there are ways to kind of combine, look at the problems that are out there that are from the same causes and combine solutions together. The same idea of relocalizing. I mean, part of the financial crisis that we're seeing right now is that we've got, you know, assets that are not grounded in a specific place with this financial transactions. The same thing's true with the climate. Part of the reason why we don't have communities that are sustainable is that we don't have energy that's sustainable and localized. We don't have local control over our natural resources. We don't have local control over financial resources. Let's talk about disaggregating all those pieces and relocalizing all those things so we have communities that are in control of their natural resources, in control of community banks, in control of capital, loans, grants to one another. There's a new set of accountability to people who are most impacted by these crises. If we look at those crises in a way that understands intersection.
So when you look at the young activists here at this mm-hmm. U.S. Social Forum that you're participating in, I mean, you're doing seminars. I mean, mm-hmm. you're doing workshops and
yep.
stuff. So I'm curious about what you're talking about relates to the work that all these young activists are engaged in and yeah. the kind of interactions you've had with them.
I mean, it's exciting. It's really dynamic. It's for example, I've been working this morning. I worked with a bunch of young folks who were here talking about access to AIDS drugs and financial support, public funding for needle exchanges in Philadelphia. It's part of an ACT UP Philadelphia group, who's also part of HealthGap, which is an global HIV-AIDS network. So we've been talking about a financial transactions tax as a way to help raise public funds for needle exchanges in Philadelphia, but also connecting that to the global health question, which, of course, is also a climate change question. As the planet warms up, we'll see incredible health impacts, particularly in the continent of Africa, which is also the place where HIV/AIDS is in crisis states because there's not support for the medical answers that are out there. That's one example of a really exciting conversation that's happening. Of course, we've been working with an Indigenous Environmental Network and other Indigenous representatives both here in the U.S. and from other parts of the world to talk about how sovereign control and self-determination on natural resources is both key to how we transition to a new economy that's based on local energy and energy sovereignty, and that, of course, is at the base of reducing our emissions, our carbon dioxide emissions, by moving to a new energy economy. So we're having conversations that, I mean, the interesting thing about the economy, mm-hmm. which is a huge concept, mm-hmm. and about the climate, which is another huge concept, is that it touches all the kinds of conversations that are happening here. It's happening everywhere across the world. So every community is feeling the financial crisis. Every community is starting to feel the climate crisis. So it's kind of naming it, calling it out, and then seeing how our work intersects that way.
It's interesting to hear how you describe it, because there's always been, there's been a disconnect, it seems to me, between people who are, for want of a better term, scholars, people who do this research into how the society functions and how the climate change and the economy interact, the stuff you work on, and grassroots activists and others on the ground who are doing this work. There's always been this divergence. They never come together. They speak different languages. They're in different places. They can't mm-hmm. put these ideas together. But this mm-hmm. is, this conference A is very much about trying to change that, and it seems that's part of what you're work is about as well.
Yeah. I mean, at IPS, that's at the Institute of Policy Studies, where I work in D.C., I mean, we're one of our, you know, our mission is to connect on kind of on the issue level is to connect peace, justice, and the environment, and to make the intersections and links very, very clear. But it's also part of our mission to do the research and writing that helps support movements and is part of the interactive learning from movements, and so yeah, we think that's actually that's the way social change happens. We, you know, we sit in D.C. and we work on policy, but I don't think we have an illusion that policy advocacy, you know, walking up to the Capitol Hill and knocking on the doors of members of Congress is the way that social change happens.
You don't, do you?
Yeah, you know. Hasn't happened yet. And so, you know, we really have an understanding. We really come from a core set of principles that says social change happens because people create movements that meet their needs. And so there's a role for research. There's a role for writing. There's a role for being able to help put ideas together and put constituencies together in an interesting way that pollinates new ideas. And we see that as part of the our work is to try and help fill that niche and help fill that space.
You're here, obviously, mm-hmm. we're talking mm-hmm. in Detroit at the U.S. Social Forum.
In body, if not in mind. Yeah.
Right.
No, you're here.
And you were at Copenhagen at that international conference where 100,000 activists from every continent on the globe were there, being led by indigenous people and women and poor people, and kind of putting to rest the notion that the environment was only about white middle class kids in America. Yeah. I mean, they're in it too, but but it's very important to see that, and I don't think I've ever seen something like that before in history, seeing that many people from that many cultures and countries together
yeah.
in one place. And then you yeah. went to Cochabamba,
yeah.
which was an indigenous environmental conference,
yeah.
and now you're here. So, and I ask you that because I'm curious how you see the connection.
Sure.
Between the three kind of amazing events that seem to be bubbling up from the bottom.
Yeah, I guess the first is that the three things happened. So I think that in itself is actually a sign that there's a kind of a critical mass. There's a critical mass of people who are critically fed up with the way things are working right now, and so are seeing different spaces as important to engage in, and seeing that there has to be a strategy that really elevates and celebrates different ways that people work. And so some people work in terms of tight policy. You know, there's that UN Framework Convention on Climate Change meeting in Copenhagen was very focused in some ways on particular policy pieces inside a structure like the UN that is very legalistic and has implications in terms of state governments, right? I think the critical mass in Copenhagen is part of what made Cochabamba happen, because a particular government, Bolivia, said, wow, there really is an outpouring of civil society attention, and we need to help figure out a way to harness that popular energy and give it an outlet in the UN space, but also help foster the energy in the public space as well. So I saw Cochabamba really as being the link between spaces like the UN, which are official spaces, quote-unquote, that are about governments making promises to one another, and places like the U.S. Social Forum, which is absolutely, in some ways, anti-statist, or at least not a part of a state program, where people are saying, we're going to make our own promises to each other from the bottom up because we care about each other and because we think it's important. And so it's just kind of interesting that Cochabamba happened in between those, because I think it actually is kind of that link in between those two kinds of spaces. It's a space that was about bringing people in relationship with each other, and about figuring out a way for that outcome to be plugged back into official spaces. So, and there was just a fascinating and exciting interactive process where I don't think this has ever happened before, where a really public, open process of putting ideas on paper through a consultative process that happened over months, and then a physical meeting where people really had fascinating debates and discussions in a room together for hours. I mean, we were in those meeting rooms for 12 hours a day, and we still, you know, we're really willing to come back the next day and have a conversation some more about really kind of detailed stuff.
This isn't Cochabamba.
This isn't Cochabamba. Mm-hmm. You know, I was working on climate finance. We had a packed room, 150 people, for 12 hours a day for 3 days in a row, of just people engaged, giving their ideas, talking about their experiences.
And all these people were indigenous leaders from
Latin America? They weren't all indigenous leaders. They were mostly people from Bolivia, mostly people from Latin America, mostly indigenous, but also, you know, people from other kinds of social movements, Via Campesina, peasant movements, people who are working on new kinds of energy, kind of the energy transition revolution, workers groups, labor groups, NGOs, environmental groups, local environmental groups, international networks of groups. I mean, it was kind of a little bit of everything, but very driven by indigenous peoples, and having that as like the overall vision. But it was exciting. I don't think it's ever happened where then that the outcome of that is put together and then enters into a UN space where it has weight as an official, because Bolivia introduced this agreement, people's agreement, into the UN space. It has party status, mm-hmm. right? So here's a global civil society movement now entering into an official state government to government space. It's interesting how it's all breaking these lines of popular versus or inside versus outside strategy. And I think what's fascinating about the social forum is that it's helping pull those lines apart too. So, you know, inside your town government, inside your city council, you know, how do we turn that inside out and then bring those messages from the streets into the official spaces and from the official spaces out into the streets? I think that's what's exciting about this space.
I wonder how you see, just also you, as an observer of all this, what you were just describing, and we've just watched how the national press and major media did not cover 10,000 people marching through the streets of Detroit,
yeah.
young people from all over this country,
yeah.
and all people, period, of this country, and yet you see 500 people in a Tea Party or 2,000 people in a Tea Party demonstration, and it's news for 10 days.
Yeah.
Do you find that what's going on here is isolated, and then it's isolated from the mass of American consciousness, and how does that shift happen, do you think?
That's I mean, I don't think it actually is isolated. I think there's a real continuous stream, but you're right. I think the media has created a bubble around it to keep it contained. I think there's a vested interest in major media corporations, which are linked to other kinds of corporations, which are linked to other kinds of power, political power, to make sure that they're isn't a sense of critical mass, to make sure there isn't a sense of fed upness with a positive outcome versus a let's tear down any kind of regulation or let's tear each other apart and let's have something based on fear and hate versus hope and compassion and positive thinking. So I think that's the difference between the Tea Party and the things that happen in the U.S. Social Forum. I guess I think the pathway forward from that is to, I think there are some wonderful pathways that exist, things like public radio, community radio, independent media, social networking. I mean, in terms of technological spaces and tools that are out there. I do think that, you know, the Tea Party is an interesting example of a bunch of people who are sick and fed up and, you know, are getting the raw end of a lot of deals. The question is, how do progressives harness that energy and anger and sense of being fed up and sick of what they're seeing? And I think it's really actually up to us to provide some easier ways for people to plug in and to channel that energy. I think it's up to us to explain a lot of the concepts that we talk about in much simpler language and start by asking people what their stories are and start by using that as illustrations of that people can relate to. And then I think kind of building on the positive examples of, you know, solidarity economies that are happening everywhere that people are a part of, but might not call it a solidarity economy, you know, a babysitting cooperative where everyone in the office babysits for someone else's kids. That's a solidarity, that's a piece of the solidarity economy. That's actually connected to people in Maine, in Florida, in California, in Washington State. So there needs to be ways that we share our stories with each other in a way that helps us understand that we're the majority of people. You know, the Tea Party isn't the majority. The people who are interested in taking care of their families and their communities are, in fact, the majority of people in the U.S.
So you think that, to conclude, you think that the work you've been doing here is meetings you've had with young activists has been effective? The interaction has been one that's kind of moved this forward a bit?
Oh, absolutely. I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think there are people right now who are really thinking about constructively engaging with one another. I think the role that, you know, that I can play here, the role that IPS plays here, that think tanks in general can play, is one of being supportive, is one of helping people articulate ideas and connect with other kinds of networks around the globe, connect with policymakers in D.C. if that's appropriate. But yeah, I absolutely see the energy that's here kind of It moves beyond the social forum walls because we all are doing work, activism at home, and doing work with our friends and colleagues in other countries. So absolutely, I think this is part of building that critical mass, and I see it as very constructive.
Janet Redmond, Institute for Policy Studies here at the U.S. Social Forum. It's been really great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And we look forward to having you on more.
Wonderful.
Take care.
Bye.
This hour you've heard the Mark Steiner Show's on-the-ground coverage from the 2010 U.S. Social Forum in Detroit. We traveled to Detroit to bring back voices of those who are working for change in communities across the country. To hear more of our interviews and see pictures from the U.S. Social Forum, please visit us on the web at www.steinershow.org. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538.